Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels. Jim Daniels is an award-winning poet and Thomas Stockham Baker Professor of English at Carnegie Mellon University. He is an author of Punching Out from Wayne State University Press, 1990, Revolt of the Crash Test Dummies, Street, and Show and Tell, New and Selected Poems, among other books and screenplays. One that I want to mention is his third collection of short stories entitled Mr. Pleasant, which just came out this fall, 2007, by Michigan State University Press, and his new book of poems, In Line for the Exterminator, which was just released by Wayne State University Press. Jim is a native of Detroit's working-class neighborhoods, and like his father and many of his friends, worked at Ford Motor Company and other jobs before earning a bachelor's degree from Alma College in 1978 and a master's degree from Bowling Green University in 1980. Hi, Jim. How you doing?
Great. It's great to be back.
Yeah. You have two new books, but we can only really talk about one at a time. So why don't you start with your new book of poems, In Line for the Exterminator?
Sure. Okay. I'd like to read a poem called Cyclone Fence Detroit, because a lot of the poems in the book deal with landscape of various kinds. Cyclone Fence Detroit. Erected between yards to keep each dog from having its day. Muddy tracks along the fence line. Time's quiet rhythmic mess. Life's etch-a-sketch moves up and down and up, traversing these streets where someone once dreamed a trombone whale to penetrate concrete, then died in his sleep. Clock numbers shuffle like a stacked deck of lottery cards, hypnotizing even unbelievers. Tree roots revolt, raising sidewalk squares into toppled dominoes. In an underground, chosen are taught to scribble their names beneath sincerely, as if it were a primitive ritual one must endure despite the lack of faith. Meanwhile, one dog sniffs and licks the fence where another has pissed. Meanwhile, a driver closes his eyes and a car lurches to a stop in bumper-to-bumper traffic. He is driving to work. He is late. Whose magnet pulls the cars through the maze? Once a dog dug beneath the fence and impaled itself. Let that be a lesson to you all, was broadcast from a slow-moving vehicle. The check was cashed and not another word was moaned or howled or spoken. Fossilized curses carved in the cement on the bridge to nowhere otherwise known as the overpass. We are constantly underthrown. We are constantly run back to catch it. Once we went on strike. We waved our orderly signs until they gave us 10 more cents an hour for the rest of our lives or until the next round of layoffs. Once we were fined for not licensing our dog. In the center of the universe, we build cars. We are not unhappy. Everyone remembers the two dogs stuck screwing in the middle of the street. We laughed till we choked, till somebody got out a hose, and we celebrated the miracle of manufactured rain, indoor plumbing, electricity, and fuel injection. The dogs slunk away, collars jingling like the soft bells of stars we used to be able to see. And let me read another poem, which is called Cool. It's about being a teenager and also about one of those first deaths that you deal with and not knowing quite what to do and maintain your coolness at that age. Cool. When Tom's dad died, wiped out by a hit-and-run driver between Toledo and Detroit, and Tom's face all cut up from his cool sunglasses exploding, I found out his dad's name was Arthur. We drunk liquor from his bottles till we grimaced and puked. I clenched my teeth as Tom headed down my street the morning after the accident to walk with me to school. His mother was a mess. He didn't know what else to do. I met him at the curb, and we listened to our steps scrape cement. Passing the Mankiewicz funeral home, we kept our heads down. We stopped for a cigarette by the drugstore, like always, before crossing the street to school. Somebody said something about his face, like maybe a girl cut him. Tom couldn't get any words out of his dry, swollen lips. I said, cut him a break, his dad just died. Then we squinted out, away from him, toward girls passing by and hot cars and crossing guards and teachers and parents heading toward work, our living parents who didn't understand. And poem said a little bit earlier than that, we all probably did some kind of science fair project, and mine was a complete disaster, which seemed to give the fathers at the fair something to identify with. It's called Open House Science Fair Project. I twisted a wire around a dry cell battery and a nail, then scraped the nail over a steel file to make sparks. I was the nail, and the world was the file, a simple story that proved nothing. My theory was, screwed if you do, screwed if you don't. That lump of a battery sat heavy on the bare wooden table, already draining despite the appearance of density and substance. The nail dangled from the wire, waiting to be pounded in its next life, as was foretold by the seers of hardware. The steel file would outlive us all. My bad grade scrawled on a note card, wrinkled with sweat in my bad pocket, where a wallet would soon be, and a comb. Around me, other projects whirred and whistled. My head lowered as if in prayer. I sent up spark after spark, scraping my knuckles as I studied greasy moons under my fingernails. Leaning on a table were fathers who stood silent and understood. And this is a poem. Eminem, the rapper, also comes from Warren, Michigan, where I spent most of my years growing up. And 8 Mile Road, which is the name of his film, was the closest big street to where I grew up. So I have this weird sort of connection or identification with him. And I read this in the paper last year, or maybe the year before, the epigraph for this poem, which is, 2 days after Eminem, Marshall Mathers, abruptly canceled his European tour, citing exhaustion and unspecified other medical issues, his spokesperson revealed that the rapper had been hospitalized for a sleep medication dependency in response to news of Eminem's hospitalization. A radio station was collecting fan signatures on a 20-foot-long Get Well card in Warren, Michigan. Warren is in Macomb County, the area where Eminem grew up. The poem is called Can't Sleep. Marshall Mathers and I cannot sleep tonight. We lie in bed and remember Warren, the same city of our separate youths, the perfect grid from 8 Mile Road to 14 Mile Road, from DeQuinder to Hayes. He is 32, I am 49. He is the illegitimate son of my memory. I count the blocks, I list street names, Dallas, Otis, Rome, Pearl, Jarvis, Garrick, Michael, Topher. Then the families who lived in every house and the children and which factory the fathers worked in and who dropped out of school and who graduated. The names of the trailer parks, the places where I got my butt kicked, where who got shot and who did the shooting, who got pregnant, who kept the baby, who didn't. But it's just 6 square miles and still I cannot sleep. If you drive these streets, you might suddenly and unknowingly end up in Sterling Heights or Hazel Park or even Centerline. But me and Marshall would know, wouldn't we, Marshall? What are you taking to get you out of the sleepless box of Warren? I've got 3 bottles in my medicine cabinet. Your mother could have been any number of my classmates, Lynn, Robin, Patty, Cindy M., Cindy R., Judy, Carrie, Marcy, Jill, Karen. I already took 1 pill, but I think I need a half of another. Our neighbor is silent tonight, though last night he was pounding a sledgehammer at 4 a.m. so hard it shook our house. We didn't try to stop him. His phone is disconnected, etc. It's that etc. that we have in common, me and him, and you, Marshall. He's alone next door now. His 2 children from 2 wives ago rarely visit. Here, my wife and 2 children, we stay put. Tonight offers no sledgehammer of an excuse. If only the houses had an upstairs, if only someone had thought to create a downtown, if only the GM/Ford/Chrysler plant had not closed down or laid off half its workers, if only someone one time had been less cruel, had gotten off us, let us up before blood was shed. I used to crave drugs that kept me up, speed, coke, the jerky knife blades and shrieking volume of rage. Tonight, the relentless silence of the sledgehammer, the legalized dancing monkey. Tonight, it's worn on the brain, the dangling muffler of what we thought we left behind. Bullets in the bottles calling our names.
If you've just tuned in, this is Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels. He's reading from his new book, In Line for the Exterminator. I want to ask you, Jim, about your work as a portrait of time and place. We were talking just briefly before the taping, and as this book has returned to Detroit, and yet the title is in line for The Exterminator, which is a reference to Kennywood Park, Pittsburgh. And you were talking about it as a book about city, Pittsburgh and Detroit. Can you talk about how those two cities merge in the book and what your loyalty is as to the poem, to the city, to the place, et cetera?
Yeah, well, Detroit has no amusement parks anymore. That's how bad things are. And it just seems like, you know, I've been in Pittsburgh since 1981, and so it's really a home for me as well. And I just felt so comfortable here since I first arrived, and I think part of it was the sense of place. Now here, as we know, you look around, the steel mills are all gone. In Detroit, they're still living and dying, and right now dying with the auto industry because they haven't been able to find anything to replace it. But there is this sense of a community that at least at one time relied heavily on one industry, on a small group of companies for its economic health and survival. And what happens to the people in that situation, again, this is a big generalization, but there is a sense of lack of control of your destiny. No matter how you work, in the larger scheme of things, you know, the company goes under, the layoffs, it's not really going to matter. And so there's this sort of pride in working hard, but there's also this sense of powerlessness in that scheme of things. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things I've been trying to capture in some of those poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really admire how you have kept with this issue of class in your books over time. And I was telling you before the taping also that if anyone goes to Detroit and you say you know Jim Daniels, that you can almost like get a free lunch at any restaurant. But I mean, they love you up there, as they should. But I mean, and one reason is that you have been consistently the voice for the working people there in your poetry. And it seems like in this book, In Line for the Exterminator, it seems like you're refining it and refining it. And in this book, it seems very clear how you're talking about class. And also, as the speaker in this book is now the voice of the father, almost, the father with children talking about violence, whereas in earlier books it was a speaker of an undefined age talking about violence and class. Can you comment on that a little bit, or maybe read another poem about
it? Yeah, no, that's a good point. I think I do see things from a different perspective, and it was a kind of choice to do another book that's essentially a kind of a Detroit book. As a writer, you never want to feel like, oh, I'm just going through the same territory with the same motions, but I do think there can be value in going back and re-examining things from a new perspective in a new way, and maybe stylistically playing around with some things too. So let me read a poem which comes from the parental side of things.
I mean, the title poem is great for that too.
Yeah, let me read the title poem. In Line for the Exterminator. A dark ride, so at Kennywood Park. It's an indoor roller coaster in the darkness, if any of you have not been to Kennywood or been on that ride. In Line for the Exterminator, four skinheads swear and sweat in fat leather behind my son and me, looping around endless rows of steel rails and the fake cinder block bunker. The ride simulates a trip through the bowels of sewers beneath the city. The skinny punks who cut in line jokingly press the panic button, a blaring echo that mimics nightmare alarms. They won't stop, though somebody's shouting, "Stop it!" Some young blacks with their girlfriends throw scowls at the skinheads. Perfume and deodorant and farts and spit and melting makeup and exploding skin, pierced or not, and tattoos and thick jewelry and tight clothing plastered against skin of all colors. My son is glassy-eyed with the room's menace. It stings, it clings. The line crawls like a whipped dog toward the dark door behind which it's promised we are all to be scared. A fake newscaster on a monitor describes a power failure. I want to ask, how many in this room make minimum wage? How many in this room will ever own a house? What if we all made a giant wad of gum and rolled it out of this park and onto the front lawn of the richest dude in the city? We've all paid our admission and had our hands stamped. Perhaps the walls are closing in on us. Hey, how many of you have been on this ride before? Yeah, certainly being in that line with my son creates a whole new layer of responsibility and protectiveness and awareness, I think, of the menace there.
And that idea of having a mature speaker in the poems in terms of age, but also in terms of, you know, these poems returning with sort of a more edgy focus has a great deal of power. Why don't you read more poems?
Okay, well, I'd like to read the first paragraph of a story called United States Street Football that is kind of like a poem that sort of builds on that sense of place that I've been talking about. It's the first paragraph of a story called United States Street Football. The flat, crumbling streets of our subdivision were laid out in a basic, unimaginative grid, except for the odd twists where Rome Street turned into Pearl Street and vice versa, crisscrossing like the passing routes we ran in the middle of the street in front of our house on Rome. We played two-handed shove, not two-hand touch. This was in large part due to Angelo's habitual protestation of, "You only got me one hand." Our only alternative was to shove him into a parked car or, if he was lucky, over the curb onto the grass in order to emphasize the second hand. But the day Angelo was hit by Pete Baroni's speeding Pontiac Firebird and slow-moed his way up into the air and bounced off the windshield as Pete swerved and kept going, a police car in hot pursuit, we had to change the rules once again and forever.
So that was from your book, Mr. Pleasant.
Yeah, we're on the same streets. That same, you know, this grid pattern, which has been on the cover of my number of books, too, which is kind of foreign to Pittsburgh, but, you know, those streets laid out in these little boxes, it seems like such a metaphor for the lives in terms of being self-contained by these four corners. And there's this kind of pressure that explodes out of that containment.
Was what was on M80?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Places Everyone and Show and Tell.
Oh, okay.
I'm probably the only one who noticed, but for me it was important.
It's making sense now, yeah. Okay.
Now, one of the things about In Line for the Exterminator is I came back to this character named Digger that I created in Places Everyone in M80, so I thought I would read a Digger poem. Digger's an auto worker, and I've sort of followed a fictional auto worker, and I followed him through his life in the factory, and in this book I have him retire, so I thought I'd read a book called Digger Turns in His ID. While thousands pass in two schools at shift change, you are an old gray fish flailing between them, trying to decide whether to be late or not on your final day. It's not like anybody can ease up on you. A body always needed at your machine, everything timed. Tomorrow, not even your ghost will stand here. Another person will don clean gloves and soil them. You scratch your name onto your machine through the grease, through the pale green paint with your car key. Loretta, your wife, packed Twinkies in your lunch and a note she says she loves you. Twinkies, so soft, so hard to swallow today. What do I do with this, you ask, holding up the note for your buddies. Wait till she's stuck with you home all day, she'll be singing a different tune, one guy says. Your plan is only to buy a rowboat with a small motor, putt-putt out to a quiet lake and fish, water lapping against aluminum. The clock's not going to surprise you this late in the game. The hours pass with stern efficiency. The plant's so big that outside your department, nobody knows you're on your way out today. Today. The foreman shakes your hand, young guy 10 years in, and the guys line up and clink their lunch buckets against yours, the factory high five, metal on metal. God bless you, Spooner says. Now don't go bringing God into it after all these years, you smile. You want to keep your ID as a keepsake, your life on a small laminated card, but they take it, company procedure. Your pension will be good. You'll be set for life, a lifer released, but not for good behavior. Another body used up? Nah. Drinks at the bar tonight? Just one. And what? Let's stop here while everyone's still sincere and the map is empty once more. Empty, but not disintegrating. Turn the key in the lock. That's right. Climb in. Deep breath. And start her up.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Jan Beatty, and my guest tonight is the poet Jim Daniels, reading from his new book, In Line for the Exterminator. So this is the final book in your trilogy on the urban landscape. Places Everyone was the first one, which won the Brittingham Prize from the University of Wisconsin Press, and then M80 from the University of Pittsburgh Press, and now this In Line for the Exterminator from Wayne State University Press. And so does that mean that this is the end of Digger? Is he retired? Is he dying? I mean, what's happening to Digger?
I'm not sure. You know, I thought I'd been done with him before, but then he pops up unexpectedly. And I think when you're working with a character or working on a series of poems, that can happen. You think you've put something behind you, and then they, in the subconscious mind, they just filter back in. But I'm assuming that this might be it for Digger, unless he shows up and surprises me again. But, you know, Places Everyone was 1985, M80 was 1993, it's 2007. So there was this nice kind of gap between the books. It gave me time to accumulate poems that deal with his aging in the factory and the effect on the factory on his life outside of work. And I feel like I might have said what I wanted to say about him.
Mm-hmm. I feel like he's going to come back. I mean, I don't want him to go, actually, you know.
Yeah, he might be pounding on the door some night, and I'll have to wake up and go downstairs and let him back in.
I think you have to let him back in. Anyway, do you have some more Digger poems? Or whatever you want to read. But
well, another factor that has been in a lot of my work over the years, and in that Jeffrey Eugenides book, what the hell is the name of that book? It's a big novel. I'm spacing on it. Anyway.
I can't help you.
This novel, part of it was set during the Detroit riots in 1967, and the line in the book was, well, in Detroit, it's always about race. And race has figured into my work in various ways, partly through growing up so close to what was considered the border between Detroit and the working class suburbs outside of it. So I thought I would read a poem that dealt with the some of the racial issues that sort of show up there and tensions. And this is right on 8 Mile Road, where this was set. It's called Detroit 1972, 3 a.m. At Top Hat Hamburgers on the Detroit side of 8 Mile Road, dirty snow smudging the curb under glum streetlights, I gripped the stainless steel counter to keep the stool from swerving. The drinking age was 18 or 16, depending on the math. I was exempt from the draft and from playing piano. 5 years since the riots, under the new math, yesterday. Outside, the world swirled past in the stretched, poisonous lights of every car speeding through the sleeping world. My first car slanted across the blurred yellow lines in the lot. A black kid, maybe at my age, scraped the grill behind the counter. Time scraped the world off the dirty road, the clock emptying out toward 4, leaving only the desperate, the lost, the overcooked. How did I end up here alone, a blue smudge of blood above one eye, 16 and flunking every quiz on my future? The kid, maybe my age, looked up at me. Oh, we hated each other instantly. And that's a poem called Death Seat. After my grandmother died, we fought over who sat up front next to my mother in the Ford Falcon with the metal dashboard and magnetic virgin and no radio. My brothers and I had the hard heads of holy youth, our brush cuts bristling with electric eternal life. None of us ever smashed our heads into that glove box with no give where my mother kept the old simple hand-drawn maps to get my grandmother to church and back, to the grocery store and back. Bold black-markered street names and our phone number just in case. My grandmother didn't buy a radio. She was already going deaf. If the virgin spoke to her, she never told us. She shrank from crumbling vertebrae until she couldn't see over the dash and my mother took over at the wheel. No one had died before my grandmother. I know now there was luck in that, the oldest being the first to go, following the map as directed. We took turns being placed on the sacrificial altar of the front seat, where we could easily die, lurching forward into metal, where we could control the imaginary radio, sliding the Virgin back and forth across the dash to tune it in. My mother drove that car for years. She could afford no other. She always knew whose turn it was. And dreamscape. There were these certain symbols of luxury or wealth in our neighborhood. One was like having a pool table. So this is called dreamscape. The sheer weight of my father's pool table, like a piano without the lessons. He stroked the deep green felt like intimate silk. He loved to break, scattering the perfect V. Each morning he grimaced a long coffee swallow, then disappeared unarmed into the factory's oily cave. He bought a short-weighted stick for cramped corner shots. Soon enough, his four boys marred that perfect green with reckless pokes and spills. He invited neighbors for beers and pool. We listened from half-sleep to his loud pride. He thought with enough chalk he could make any shot. My girlfriend and I knocked balls together while we kissed and groped. She sat on the edge while I unzipped her jeans. We were pool fanatics. He bought a ping-pong table to fit on top for family meals. The factory slowly made him deaf. The slate developed a pronounced sag, and the felt eroded into baldness. When he retired, he took a chainsaw and cut it into pieces to carry out the door. No one remembered how he got it down there. And this is a sonnet for the professional wrestler The Sheik, who was from Detroit. I think he may have wrestled Bruno Sammartino from Pittsburgh at some point. But the New York Times, he was well enough known to get his obit in the Times. And what the Times said was, "The Sheik's pioneering sadism clearly established his credentials." And I had to go with that. Elegy for the Sheik. In a tiny TV studio in Windsor, the Sheik railed and raved. In our living room, we closed the drapes to cut Saturday afternoon glare. The camera withered under the Sheik's evil stare. On the lumpy couch, our father dozed open-mouthed through our shouts and shrieks and other comforting sounds of home, roof leak, and furnace groan. The Sheik's gory mumbled prose translated from gibberish by the weasel into a double dare to Bobo Brazil or Bull Curry with the cauliflowered ears. The foreign object ultimately emerged at the close, stabbing a blood capsule open to please the studio freaks and geeks and us. Born in Detroit, Arab headgear notwithstanding, the Sheik did not make cars, he made his landings.
It's the poetry of Jim Daniels. Thanks so much, Jim.
Thank you, Jan. It was a lot of fun.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment news weekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Alan Waite. Our sound engineer is Brian Sawarik. Please tune in every Tuesday night at 7 for Prosody here on Independent Public Radio, 91.3 WYEP.